news. Bush's foreign minister has blasted the U.S. for its unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. British officials put several armed Navy boats on standby to help protect the U.K.'s fishing waters in case of a no-deal Brexit. And a senior U.S. Republican Party official calls for formation of a union by, quote, law-abiding states after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a bid to overturn election results. Thanks for joining us. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has blasted the U.S. for its unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and its reimposition of sanctions on Tehran. Lavrov said that Washington should be blamed for the problems surrounding the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Said that Russia is against mixing the deal with other issues. While rejecting any revision or amendments to the Iran nuclear deal, top Russian diplomats stressed that the JCPOA is a great achievement and that Moscow will support Tehran through certain measures. Called the U.S. stance towards the multilateral accord unconstructive. However, he hailed Iran for fulfilling its commitments despite Washington's punitive measures. Lavrov said that unilateral sanctions by the U.S., the EU, and their allies are in violation of international laws and have negative consequences that must be taken into account by the U.N. Britain's Royal Navy boats are being prepared to protect the country's fishing waters in case the UK and the EU fail to reach a post-Brexit trade deal. The vessels are on standby to guard British waters from EU fishermen in case of a no-deal on fishing rights after the Brexit transition period ends on December the 31st. Navy officers will also be allowed to board foreign vessels and arrest fishermen. Fishing has been one of the sticking points in talks, which are fast approaching their end on Sunday, with both sides saying no agreement is likely. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the talks over a post-Brexit trade deal with the EU are deadlocked.
The argument today is about the terms on which we trade with the European Union. And the issue at the moment is that they want, the talks in Brussels are stymied, deadlocked, because they want to keep us locked into a system by which every time they change their laws, we have to change our laws. And we don't think that's a brilliant idea. They also want
to keep them out of Johnson said, however, that British companies will enjoy big opportunities in case of a no-deal Brexit. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also told bloc leaders that a no-deal is the most likely scenario. Meanwhile, the Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin said that his country still hopes a last-minute deal. Speaking after an EU meeting in Brussels, Martin said the Irish economy would be damaged in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Johnson and von der Leyen have given negotiators till Sunday evening to break the current deadlock. The head of the Republican Party in the U.S. state of Texas has suggested forming a union after the country's apex court rejected a lawsuit seeking to overturn the presidential election results. In a statement, Alan West said that the Supreme Court's order had established a precedent that allows states to violate the Constitution and not to be held accountable. He said the law-abiding states should form a union that will abide by the Constitution. This came after the top court tossed up the Texas lawsuit to overturn Joe Biden's victory in the states of Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The ruling is considered as a crushing setback for the incumbent President Donald Trump's quest to undo his election loss to Biden. Trump's team has already suffered multiple court defeats in similar cases in other states. However, he still refuses to concede, continuing fraud claims.
In a historic first, 18 states, led by Texas, sued four states over the long-running controversy of mail-in ballots. It was by far the most serious challenge yet to the integrity of the recent U.S. presidential election. The crux of the lawsuit was not related to the widespread allegations of, so far unproven, criminal conspiracy to commit voter fraud, but a question of constitutional law. The lawsuit asserted that constitutional law was broken months ago when some state governors bypassed state legislatures via executive order to issue unprecedented numbers of mail-in ballots. However, just 3 days before the Electoral College votes to decide the president, the Supreme Court rejected the lawsuit in a huge win for the projected victory of challenger Joe Biden. Biden supporters voiced relief and exasperation that election challenges are continuing for so long.
The real issue is there's no merit to the case. Why are we doing this? How many court cases do they have to be satisfied? There's probably going to be 25% of this public that still will never believe that he won that. But he did, fair and square.
Trump supporters are likely to now criticize the Supreme Court for allegedly playing politics and for not agreeing to hear the case in public. The lawsuit had been joined by the incumbent Donald Trump, two-thirds of all Republicans in the House of Representatives, and polls consistently show that 80% of Republican voters still believe challenger Joe Biden's projected win was due to vote fraud.
I don't think people accepted the results of the last election, so I think just as a two-party country, you're always going to have people that oppose it no matter what, and that will continue to happen no matter who won the election.
What's certain is that this is not the last election-related dispute. The lawsuit indicates the depth of grassroots and elite support for more unprecedented legal battles in order to decide who is the rightful president in this ever more divided nation. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin.
Hello, welcome to the news review. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has moved forward with a major arms sales to Morocco. The package is worth $1 billion and includes drones and precision-guided weapons. The White House has reportedly sent a notice to Congress about the potential deal. This would be among the first drone sales under the Trump administration. The move comes after Washington announced a U.S. brokered agreement for the normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. Earlier this year, the U.S. offered F-35 jet fighters to the United Arab Emirates as part of a deal to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joins us from Edinburgh. We also have Barry Grossman, who's an international lawyer, joining us from Bali. Mick Napier, first over to you. Another country coming out announcing the normalization deals. Let me restate that. Morocco actually has said it's a resumption of their relationship, but it's now out in the open. So this comes after, what, decades of, close relationship that they have had when it comes to the military arena, et cetera. Hezbollah has come out and said that's a stab in the back to Palestinians. How do you see it?
It's both. It is something out in the open which has been operating in the shadows, and not even deep shadows, for a very long time. But, you know, I think it's not just that this is open. It's that Trump wouldn't object to being compared to a mafia don. But what he's done is he's brought Israel and Morocco together, and he said, look, Morocco has to give the Palestinians to Israel, and Israel has to agree that Morocco can take over the area and ignore the people of what used to be the Spanish Sahara, the Western Sahara. It's the Sykes-Picot division of, you know, changing of borders in the Middle East, number two. In the same way that the Balfour Declaration gave Palestine to European colonists, the future of people in the Middle East, Arab people in the Sahara and in Palestine, is now being decided in Washington with compliant regimes simply carrying them out. So yes, it's out in the open, and we know that Morocco has been working with Israel for a very long time. Morocco's been using Israeli spy technology to harass its own dissidents, courageous journalists who call out the corruption of the regime. We know that last year, some world judo championship took place in Morocco. To their great credit, a couple of Algerian participants refused to go up against an Israeli participant because that would be normalization. But the Israeli flag flew over the championships, the competition, when a couple of Israelis won. There seems to be very little limit to the shame that these Arab regimes are prepared to to debase themselves to. I mean, not only did the United Arab Emirates accept this fantastic weapons deal in order to normalize with Israel, but, you know, one of the Khalifas actually bought the Israeli football team, Beitar, which chants kill the Arabs, and, you know, which is the most racist anti-Arab institution possibly in a very crowded scene in Israel. There seems to be no limit to the shame that these Arab regimes are prepared to abase themselves to in order to ingratiate themselves with Washington and with Tel Aviv. Are there any red lines? I don't know that there are any.
Barry Grossman, you know, when you take a look at what is being formed here, in terms of the sales, I mean, I wonder which one came first, military sales to Morocco and then the normalization deal announcement or vice versa. But regardless, you have the sale that was announced right away. You also have that F-35 jets that were announced and then eventually were sold to Abu Dhabi. What or Dubai, what kind, do you see any, what is the bigger picture here when it comes to this, the military sales, weapon sales to these countries?
Well, look, first of all, this is all bringing out into the open the fact that the U.S., perhaps somewhat inspired by Saudi Arabia, is engaging in the worst kind of morally corrupt checkbook diplomacy that we can imagine. To me, it's no great surprise that Morocco has stepped down in order to normalize with Israel, bearing in mind that, as I recall, Morocco was one of the very first nations to recognize the unilateral declaration of existence by Israel in 1948. But what we need to look at in this particular scenario is that there seems to have been three very clear parts to this deal. On the one hand, Morocco agreeing to normalize, further normalize with Israel. But on the other hand, the U.S. Presuming unilaterally to gift Morocco with what we know as the Spanish Sahara, the former colony of Spain, which in terms of expanse is not really a great deal smaller than Morocco itself. And of course, therein comes another parallel. This is really a story about two very ill-conceived partitions overseen, engineered by the United Nations, and the resulting annexation of one side of the partition by the other party. Of course, we see in Palestine that it was the, even though the partition didn't ultimately go ahead, it was Israel, the occupation, that has for decades now, with full Atlantic world support, annexed most of Palestine. And in Morocco and Western Sahara, it's been Morocco that has annexed the lion's share of what was known as Western Sahara. But what we now need to be aware of course, is that this spells out the very real possibility of another armed conflict boiling over in the region over there, with Algeria known to support the independence movement. And a spokesman on behalf of the independence movement saying, now that this deal has been done, it seems extremely unlikely that people will ever get to vote in the referendum that was promised to them back in 1991. And as a result, there's a very real likelihood that there will be a war. And that war could very well draw Algeria into it, so we could see a war between Morocco and Algeria. And it will be another scenario that could very well set up a sort of proxy war between the U.S. and Russia. The deputy Russian foreign minister has come out and denounced that part of this deal, namely the U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, is being completely absurd and contrary to international law. But none of that seems to bother the United States, which considers itself so exceptional that it's not bound by the very same body of laws and traditions and conventions that it seeks to impose on, very selectively, I might add, on other countries around the world whenever it sees itself in a position to gain some advantage by doing so. The U.S. doesn't consider itself in any way bound by any of that, and this is yet another example of how horribly they behave abroad and more specifically throughout Africa and the Middle East.
Thank you for that, international lawyer Barry Grossman. Mick Napier, thank you. Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. That is it for another news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says that his government is taking all necessary measures for the production of a coronavirus vaccine domestically. Rouhani said the government is ready to fully assist science-based organizations doing researches on COVID vaccines. He added that Iran is willing to purchase a vaccine from abroad once it is approved by the country's health ministry. The Iranian president, however, called on the citizens to abide by health protocols and to avoid gatherings, especially during the upcoming ceremonial events. He stressed that asymptomatic patients and those having no clear signs of the virus would pose a greater threat to the people. Rouhani also hailed Iranian experts and specialists for their help in dealing with a deadly disease inside the country. 5 years ago, the Nigerian army attacked supporters of top Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. Hundreds were killed, many more arrested, including the cleric and his wife. Despite a high court ruling, Zakzaki and his wife have remained in jail as part of a government crackdown ongoing since the Zaria killings.
A massacre in Nigeria. The target, supporters of the country's Islamic movement led by top cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. At least 300 were killed and hundreds more injured by the Nigerian army in the northern city of Zaria from December the 12th to the 14th, 2015. The army said Zakzaki's supporters had refused to clear a road for a military convoy to pass and accused them of attacking the convoy. But witnesses told Human Rights Watch that the army attacked Zakzaki's supporters at three locations, including a mosque, opening fire at them. Some said soldiers opened fire at the people coming out of the mosque without provocation. HRW released a report a week after the massacre, calling the Nigerian army attack unjustified.
The Nigerian military's version of events does not stack up. It is almost impossible to see how a roadblock by angry young men could justify the killings of hundreds of people. At best, it was a brutal overreaction, and at worst, it was a planned attack on the minority Shia group.
Another international rights group, Amnesty International, said the army tried to cover up its crimes in Zaria. Amnesty made the conclusion in its April 2015 report that contained evidence compiled through witness testimony and satellite images.
It is clear that the military not only used unlawful and excessive force against men, women, and children, unlawfully killing hundreds, but then made considerable efforts to try to cover up these crimes.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were arrested during the Zaria attack. A year after the carnage, the Abuja High Court ordered their release. But the Nigerian government defied the order. It has kept Zakzaki and his wife in jail, despite their worsening health conditions. The Zaria massacre was the beginning of a government crackdown against Zakzaki's supporters and his movement. Scores of the movement members have been killed during peaceful rallies on various occasions, calling for his release. On July the 28th, 2019, the government announced a ban on the Islamic movement in Nigeria, accusing it of engaging in terrorist activities. The move drew a strong reaction from Human Rights Watch.
Allegations of criminality do not present legitimate grounds to ban the activities of a religious group, including protests for justice and the release of their leader. The ban on the Shia movement may portend an even worse security force crackdown on the group, which could have dire human rights implications throughout Nigeria.
Rights groups have repeatedly demanded justice for those killed in Zaria, but the calls have fallen on deaf ears. No probe done, no one punished. The crackdown has continued on IMN supporters, a minority group active mostly in northern Nigeria.
And that is World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
On the issue of Palestine, a few weak and humiliated governments defied the world of Islam and the Islamic Ummah by ignoring the Palestinian cause, and by establishing relations with the usurper and murderer. Undoubtedly, all these maladies will be cured with the unity of the Islamic Ummah, and the problems that Islamic governments and nations are suffering from. Wherever you look, there are many problems from Kashmir to Libya will be eliminated thanks to the Muslims' unity. These statements were about Unity Week.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
As for the issue of the 13th of Aban, it is interesting that this year's 13th of Aban, the day of fighting against arrogance, has coincided with the birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet. This reminds us of the Holy Ayah, Muhammad is the Apostle of Allah, and those who are with him are strong against kuffar, compassionate amongst each other. The Holy Quran, chapter 48, verse 29. On the one hand, there is a birthday, and on the other hand, there is this strong against kuffar. The movement that our youth launched was a great movement. The 13th of Aban is the manifestation of the Iranian nation's fight against arrogance. It was not the case that they had problems with a few people residing in an embassy. Rather, the issue was an important symbolic endeavor in fighting against arrogance, a move that was duly carried out. Well, the American regime is an arrogant regime, and an arrogant regime is a collection of many detriments, mischiefs, and evil things. An arrogant regime is warmongering, terrorist, and also a cultivator of terrorists. It is interfering, corrupt, and monopolistic. When we speak of an arrogant regime, arrogance contains all these ugly notions, evil things, and mischiefs. Therefore, fighting against such arrogance and such a phenomenon is synonymous with reality. Therefore, fighting against such arrogance and such a phenomenon is synonymous with rationality. Some people claim that this was against reason and acumen, but it was not against reason. Rather, it was the manifestation of rationality. It would be irrational to surrender and to give in to that regime.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
A nearly three-decade-old ceasefire has ended in occupied Western Sahara, marking the onset of upcoming tensions in the region.
The opposing sides are the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement that seeks independence from the monarchy.
The Polisario is mobilizing thousands of volunteers to join for the fight after the Moroccan military broke into Guéguerat, a restricted area technically under Polisario sovereignty.
Morocco has publicly and officially acknowledged the fact of launching an armed attack on a group of civilians demonstrating peacefully in Western Sahara.
I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya.
And I am Ikram Abdikarim. Welcome to Africa Today. In this episode, we take you to the Western Sahara, where open warfare appears to be on the horizon.
Now, fighting has reportedly broken out in several areas between the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, and it could have impacts far beyond Morocco.
I have also prepared news from all over Africa for you. Stay with us for the next 25 minutes.
In Africa's last colony.
I say that our damnation comes from the natural resources we have here. If it wasn't for these natural resources, Morocco would never have invaded Western Sahara.
If we don't speak out, especially us as victims who have suffered all of this, if we don't speak out and defend our cause, this problem will remain.
Hostilities began after a Morocco-built road was reportedly blocked by the Polisario, and the kingdom's trade route with Mauritania was cut. Violation of the ceasefire after 29 years since it was clinched could undermine peace and security in the rest of the region. The ceasefire agreement was reached between the Polisario Front and Morocco after several engagements between 1989 and 1991.
We are sure, as we are sure that God exists, that the Saharan people's objective is independence. And that is a right we must address today, tomorrow, next year, in our time, in our children's time. It doesn't matter when. The important thing is to achieve national independence. The conditions we are living in, the weakness in policy and failures of the Moroccan kingdom, the importance of the Saharan case in the world today, and the focus of Saharan people on independence are indicators that victory is imminent. Independence is imminent.
The kingdom has managed to occupy and administer 80% of the territory.
Since then, thousands have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation.
The media blockade Moroccans have imposed on Western Sahara is also quite infamous.
We are now joined by Mr. Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest from London. Mr. Hamdi, thanks for joining us. Now, can you walk us through the latest round of violence in Western Sahara?
There is a road that goes from Morocco to Mauritania that is used for the transport of goods. There was a protest that took place from the inhabitants of the Western Sahara. The Moroccan government accused these groups of being part of the Polisario. It's not clear if they were. So they sent in the army, which fired warning shots. The Polisario say that the Moroccans actually fired on the protesters. And the Moroccan army moved into that area, which is a buffer zone, built a sand wall in order to try to prevent that road from being blocked again. The Moroccans believe that the Polisario are trying to force a new war, and the Polisario believe that the Moroccans are further cementing their de facto control of much of the territory.
Thanks for that, Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest magazine.
Western Sahara has been occupied by Morocco since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. Although the four-decade-old conflict has its roots in nearly a century of brutal colonization by Spain. Madrid agreed to hand over Western Sahara to Mauritania and Morocco in 1975, triggering tensions that continue to this day.
On the 21st of October, Polisario bring women and children and block the crossing point of Gargarat. Immediately, the Secretary General have been alerted by Morocco, and we alerted also the Security Council. And since 21st of July, of October, Secretary General made two calls to Polisario to withdraw from Gargarat, not to block civil and commercial traffic, and also not to change the statutes of this area.
Pro-independence Sahrawis living in the occupied territory stage more and more protest against the Moroccan rule established with the help of the United States.
Morocco reportedly took military action hours after U.S. Major General Andrew Rohling met with the commander of the Royal Moroccan Armed Forces Southern Zone.
We are now joined by Mr. Edward Corrigan, an international lawyer from Ontario, to hear his take on the significance of this meeting.
Well, obviously, the United States is a supporter of the Kingdom of Morocco. Morocco is considered a conservative Arab government. It's under, very, quietly supported by the Americans. And obviously, the American generals gave green light to Morocco to for any invasions or going into the buffer zone. So the Americans are definitely involved. Morocco has, a history of a poor human rights record, not only in the old Spanish Sahara, but also in its own country. And there's some allegations that the Polisario Front also has some human rights problems.
Now, relations between the Moroccan and the U.S. militaries have grown in recent years, mostly thanks to cooperation over the American military command in Africa, AFRICOM.
Just recently, the United States and Morocco signed an accord that aims to strengthen military cooperation over the next decade.
Morocco hosts one of the largest training exercises organized by AFRICOM. It's called the African Lions Annual Exercise, where countries from all over Africa participate. It's usually held provocatively, I think, in southern Morocco, not too far from Western Sahara. So it certainly does. It's not good optics that Morocco chose to launch this military incursion in violation of the UN ceasefire on the same day that military commanders were in Morocco preparing for the annual African Lion Exercise.
Now, Washington is the monarchy's largest supplier of arms, and it hosts an annual U.S. military exercise called African Lion. Morocco signed a peace treaty with the U.S. in 1786, which is still in force today.
The Moroccan government also enjoys support from some U.S. region allies, such as Turkey and the UAE.
I think the U.S. has been trying to deploy as much as it can in terms of leverage in order to push other countries to normalize ties with Israel, whether that's by making promises of recognizing Moroccan control of the Western Sahara, or whether that's by making promises of incentives to push Morocco to assert what it believes is its right to the Western Sahara. This is all possible. However, it's not a guarantee that Morocco necessarily responded to these U.S. demands. The reality is that there were the road was blocked. There were protests. The Polisario have acknowledged that as well. It does affect transport of goods between Morocco and Mauritania.
The latest round of tensions in the rest of region could spiral out of control. Neighboring Algeria, which is home to Sahrawi refugees, could be dragged into the conflict, potentially causing an all-out war. Major weapon sales to Morocco by the Trump administration have even raised concerns, yielding a scenario which Morocco might be looking for a U.S. recognition of Western Sahara in exchange for Rabat's recognition of Israel.
إسرائيل ليست عدوا للمغرب على أي حال ليست عدوا للمغرب بل في الماضي قدمت بعض الخدمات استعلاماتية واستخباراتية
على كل حال هذا ما يقوله محور معين في الإقليم
هذه هي الحقيقة يا أستاذة
بالنسبة لك هناك محور آخر لا يعتبر هذا
يعني ليس
حقيقة
ليس هناك احتقان إسرائيلي أو حقد إسرائيلي على المغرب
The U.S. even got close to recognizing Western Sahara as Moroccan territory under the George W. Bush administration. Meanwhile, the Sahrawi civilians remain the true victims, wary of empty promises by the U.N. Security Council and the U.N. Secretariat, and no resolution in sight.
This is all part of the mess that the Europeans created after in Africa, where they divided up the country in the 1984 Berlin Conference. But, you know, all of the countries and the lines and the map, you know, really don't correspond to the ethnic groups in the area and linguistic groups. So, you know, that's why there's so much instability in Africa, where these countries are, you know, trying to live under these artificial lines. And as I've read elsewhere, Africans just sort of ignore the lines. They just do whatever they want. So that's the issue. So until the Americans get serious and the European Union gets serious.
And now my colleague is ready to present you with news and events from across Africa. What do you have in store for us today, Kram?
Thank you, Henya. Welcome back to more news from all over Africa. And now, on to the first one. World's white giraffe has been fitted with a track device in Kenya to protect it from poachers, as one white female and her calf were killed by poachers in March. Its white appearance is due to leucism, which causes skin cells to have no pigmentation. Parliament approves deal for Rwanda Air to fly to 5 new routes. Rwanda ratified agreements with Brazil, Democratic Republic of Congo, Namibia, Somalia, and Tunisia, bringing the total number of bases ratified by Parliament to 52. The country is also expected to sign agreements with South Korea and Malta. Thirdly, Burkina Faso election takes place amid terrorist threats. People have voted in Burkina Faso's presidential election, although polls are closed in parts of the north and east because of fears of terrorist violence. Now, clashes with police sparked by the arrest of Ugandan presidential candidate and former pop star Robert Chagulani, commonly known as Bobby Wine, has left at least 28 people dead since Wednesday. He was later charged with spreading coronavirus at a campaign rally. Police in Uganda have a right to shoot protesters dead if they reach a certain level of violence, Security Minister Eli Temwini has said. Also in West Africa, Nigerian photographer Obinna Obioma is using creative ways to display an iconic West African plastic bag to reflect on migration. Recognized around the world in either its blue, white, and red, white varieties, this once nameless bag in West Africa has long been especially popular in markets across the region. Last but not least, Nigeria's economy slips into recession. Sixth, Nigeria has slipped into recession, with the latest growth figures showing the economy's contracted 2.06% between April and June. The country has now seen two consecutive quarters of declining growth, the usual definition of recession. I hope you enjoyed the news. Don't forget to comment, and interactions are highly welcome. And stay tuned for more from me and the entire Africa team today. Thank you.
Tensions in Africa's last colony.
A full-blown military conflict in the disputed desert territory in northwest Africa could exacerbate the lives of locals already under pressure.
With a protracted war in Libya, long simmering insurgency in Mali, and an armed conflict in Ethiopia, hostilities in Western Sahara add to regional instability.
Now, the Polisario Front argues that the resumption of armed struggle is aimed at defending the legitimate rights of Sahrawis.
Frankly speaking, at the moment, it's very difficult to talk about any peaceful negotiations because Morocco has already launched a military attack on our land and our people, to which we have had to respond. So it all depends on how the developments on the ground. But if you just allow me very quickly to remind your viewers that the whole crisis started when Morocco launched an attack on a group of civilians who were protesting peacefully against Morocco's illegal occupation of Western Sahara, a violation that the United Nations...
The sparsely populated territory has worried international observers, who fear it could turn into a hub for terrorists. Natural resources are meanwhile being plundered, from phosphates to fish.
Now, in order to isolate the southern parts of the Western Sahara, Morocco also built a 2,700-kilometer sand wall in the 1980s, which is equipped with a barrier mine belt, thought to be the longest continuous minefield in the world.
I think there's always a risk of that, but I do think that there is little appetite on both sides for an all-out war. And I think the key reason for that is that Morocco has been able to access the Western Saharan area and been able to invest and take advantage of the area economically. I think Algeria is not in the mood to get engaged in a conflict, given that the president is ill, given that the country is going through transition, given that the regime is under significant pressure from its own domestic situation, whether that's corona, whether that's the popular protest. And Mauritania is engaged in a bitter political struggle, the third player in this, in a bitter political struggle between the former president and the current president.
Rabat seeks to secure passage of trucks to Mauritania via Gargarat border crossing. Morocco has also played down the clashes occurred, asserting that the three-decade truce still stands. But does it? Morocco, on the other hand, says that its activities in Western Sahara are merely aimed at free circulation of civilian and commercial traffic with neighboring Mauritania.
This route is important when it comes to the movement of civilians and goods, and because such actions were a violation of the UN-sponsored ceasefire agreement, Morocco, in order to fulfill its duties, ordered its military forces to intervene and build a sand barrier to protect the area from any future breaches.
Morocco considers the resource-rich territory of Gargarat as the integral part of the kingdom. Gargarat is located on the southern coast of the disputed Western Sahara, along the road leading to Mauritania.
Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area, irrespective of the ceasefire lines, and Algeria has been able to benefit because it's always been able to use the Western Sahara as a way to keep Morocco embroiled in separate issues instead of antagonizing Algeria from Algeria's perspective. So it may well be that what Polisario is doing is trying to flex its muscles, in given that Algeria itself is looking at other military priorities. Almost as the Polisario is saying, Algeria, we're still here, so make sure you continue to support us.
The Gugurat standoff exposes the vulnerability of Morocco's strategy of driving business growth as a major player in the sub-Saharan economy.
The latest round of violence also represents culmination of diplomatic failures to broker a sustainable peace deal to determine who controls Africa's last colony.
Now, after decades of disputes, Morocco's strategy appears to be refusing self-determination, and Polisario is rejecting Rabat's autonomy.
Power players in the region are also taking the chance to employ Western Sahara as a proxy for a wider struggle for influence in Northwest Africa. So, what repercussions can the conflict have for the region?
It depends if the regional countries are actually in favor of war. I think when it comes to analyzing the Polisario's propensity for war, or not propensity, if they have their desire for a renewed conflict, that all depends on the mood in Algeria, which is one of the prime backers of the Polisario, and the extent to which the Polisario believes that it will be able to secure international sympathy for its case, for its cause, for what's going on in the region. I do think that Morocco itself is not interested in a full-blown conflict. The reality is that both Morocco and Algeria, the two key international players in this conflict, are both happy with the status quo. Morocco, because it's been able to develop and invest and take advantage of the Western Saharan area.
Different generations of Sahrawis have grown up in refugee camps in Algeria, with no resolution surrounding their fate as the indigenous inhabitants of the region. Yet for Rabat, Western Sahara is a matter of national security, and King Mohammed IV has threatened to respond to any threat severely.
The journalists, observers, and activists who come from abroad are expelled. So what do? We break through this blockade from within. We are the witnesses. I'm going to suffer. If I do this work, I suffer more, yes. I'm going to make more sacrifices. But if I don't, I will always live under occupation.
Rabat appears to be entrenching the occupation by betting on time in what it portrays as an ongoing political process. The process, which had already failed, now looks way more distant as new clashes break out and hostilities increase.
That would be serious. And of course, Morocco, I think, is looking for, you know, seizing the resources of the area, and maybe, you know, oil, gas, other things. And while Morocco has control of the seaside and 80% of the territory, the Polisario Front controls 20% along the Algerian and Mauritanian border. But it is, yeah, most definitely could explode into something very serious. But, you know, we are talking about there's only 60,000 people, 600,000 people that live in the area.
The United Nations has expressed grave concerns over the possible consequences of the conflict. The UN has also vowed to do its utmost to avoid the collapse of the 1991 ceasefire.
A UN mission known as MINURSO is also present on the scene, but will any of that be helpful?
The Secretary General remains committed to doing his utmost to avoid the collapse of the ceasefire that has been in place since 6 September 1991. And he is determined to do everything possible to remove all obstacles to the resumption of the political process.
Just recently, the UN Security Council decided to extend the mandate of the United Nations peace operation in Western Sahara for another year.
Delegates also called for a swift appointment of a new personal envoy of the UN Secretary General to push for the Western Sahara peace process. Now the new clashes are presenting a new challenge to the world body, stopping an all-out war.
It's, you know, a low-level conflict, but it could easily explode into something much more serious and possibly bring in, Algeria into the conflict as well, as well as Morocco, and depending on what the Americans would do. But they've been supporting Morocco and have been consulting them and providing them arms. So yeah, it could explode, but this conflict has been going on actually for many, many years. But since Spain withdrew in 1975, then Mauritania withdrew under pressure from the Polisario Front later. But it's not a densely populated area. There's a little over, not even 600,000 people in the area.
Thanks for that, Mr. Corrigan.
Today, Sahrawis have no reason to believe in the words of the UN, which promised a referendum in 1991, but has done nothing to make it actually happen. The native population is therefore fighting for freedom as more troops head to Moroccan positions along the separation wall.
I do think that the Polisario, which relies on international backing in order to stand up to Morocco, may find that international backing lacking in this current environment in which the region finds itself in, or in particular the current environment in which each of the individual countries find themselves in as a result of their domestic struggles.
According to some reports, the Moroccan military has shown weak performance in some instances, allowing Polisario forces to take over some positions easily.
As tensions soar, the Moroccan media has mostly remained silent as if nothing is happening.
This is why the Sahrawis' right to self-determination are being denied, a denial coupled with reports of heavy crackdown on protests. People are suffering, but the news never gets out.
That wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today.
And we pray for the end of violence and suffering all over the world.
Please know that your thoughts and comments are always welcome.
Until we come back again, it's goodbye from me, Mubarak Kenya.
And goodbye from me, Ikram Abdikarim, and the entire team.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salaamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing here on IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining with us, and I'm your host, Hasnain, and we have our guest speaker with us, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya Qum. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad, so one of our listeners has sent us their question. Let me read it for you. It says that, my child is 3 and alhamdulillah, she has many toys at home. However, she is very possessive about her toys. And whenever we have other kids at home, it's constant fight and battle. Because she just doesn't want to share. I have now stopped calling her friends home. I'm not sure how healthy that is. What can I do? So Brother Miqdad, there's another problem faced by our parents. So we usually get to see that children don't like to share their toys with others. What do you have to say about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is a natural phase that perhaps happens in many cases, in many children. It's part of their growth. It's part of the natural phases that children go through.
Yeah.
That it comes a point where they realize that they own something, and they feel possessive about that. And they feel that this is mine and it's not yours, and you can't have it. There's a couple of things I'd like to mention before I go on to a couple of suggestions regarding this. It's important to make sure that we give the child the space to explore this possession,
okay.
Right? It comes back to something we talked about in the previous show as well, about this feeling of safety,
yeah.
Right? Children need that their parents give them support and make them feel safe about what they own.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why children become possessive is because they feel that it might be taken away from them.
Oh.
Right, so I don't want to share because if I give it to you, then you'll just take it from me, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not a rational feeling. It's not a rational thing, but children don't have the capacity to explore or to think it irrationally, right, like this. The key is that for parents to really give them the support.
Yeah.
So the worst thing that parents can do over here is to snatch the toy from their child and give it to the other child.
Yeah.
This actually creates a mistrust, a lack of trust, and actually a feeling of an anger, basically, that not only I was insecure by my possession, but now I'm even more insecure because my parents are on against me, basically.
Yeah.
They're removing this feeling of safety that I wanted to build in regards to the possessions that I have. So the first point is that parents should make the child feel really safe about their possession, that what you possess, don't worry, it won't be taken away from you.
Yeah, it remains with you.
It remains with you. Now, this goes even a long way in terms of even the relationships as well. Parents,
yeah.
you know when a child is very young, a baby, a couple of months old, baby, even under the age of 1.5, they should always feel that even their parents are like that as well.
Yeah.
They should never feel insecure about their parents' presence. So this is why we often say that parents should always be available for their baby. Especially the mom.
Yeah.
Especially the mom. Mom should always be available for the baby before the age of 1.5.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be ever the case that the baby feel that I've lost my mom or I don't have access to my mom, because they feel this what it creates from this is a fear that I can lose my mom. I can lose what I own,
yeah.
Basically. And this fear is not healthy for growth.
Yeah.
On the contrary, what we should give to our children is a feeling of safety.
Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, and dear listeners, stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Wait, stop! I got Mary Jane!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have 2 boys, one is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5, and they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this?